Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, this is Martina Navratilova.
Hi, I'm Mats Wilander.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport, brought to you this week once again from the pub in Putney, because David Law... It was such a roaring success last time. We thought we'd come back for more.
Yeah, we haven't got anything quite as serious as we had last week to talk about. Although one might argue with Maria Sharapova's return that that's not quite true. But it doesn't feel quite as ominous in terms of something that we need to quietly refer to. So, you know, we've come down the pub to have a few drinks. What can I say?
Yes, Two Beers Law is in attendance. He is currently in disguise as One Beer Law, so fun won't be had until the latter portion of the podcast, but it's worth sticking around for, if you're wondering. Yes, you've stolen my thunder there, David, because of course Maria Sharapova has made her return this week. I had a big pun prepared there about a controversial and exciting wild card, making a run to the title at the Stuttgart Open. Laura Siegmund.
Well, it still worked, Catherine. You got a laugh out of me. I didn't know what your pun would be, and it still made me chuckle. So very well done there. Oh, by the way, did you hear the Nick Kyrgios special, Tennis Podcast Extra, the first one? What did you think?
Yes, well, if the Tennis Podcast presenters aren't listening to their special extra episodes, then I'm not sure we can expect anybody else out there to. Yes, I did. And it was highly enjoyable. It affirmed for me that he is a lovely chap.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. A really likeable, imperfect young man with a basically good, decent head on his shoulders, and as imperfect, has some perfecting to do. But yeah, basically a decent human being who can be just the most wonderful power for good in tennis.
Yeah, very interesting to listen to Leighton Hewitt on it. I was speaking about it obviously with Simon Briggs. If you haven't heard that edition, do go and look it up. If you're only listening or downloading once a week, Tennis Podcast Extra is something we put out on Friday, and you can go and have a listen to 10 minutes of Nick Kyrgios talking to Simon Briggs of The Telegraph, and another 10 minutes of Leighton Hewitt talking to me. And just so interesting to chart their respective pathways through tennis, because I was sort of there at the start of Leighton Hewitt's career in 1998 when he was a 16-year-old, is pretty much when I started out on the tennis circuit, and it's not that dissimilar in terms of controversial moments, in terms of issues that occurred. Totally different kinds of reasons, because with Hewitt, there was never a suggestion that he would tap out of a match or burn out and have those sorts of issues on court. It was more combustible offences of him just bubbling over and not being able to handle not winning when he's given absolutely everything, and in the process upsetting people with things he might have said in those terms.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really easy to forget now with Leighton Hewitt, because he spent so long out there scurrying around at the back of the court, earning and winning the media's respect, the fans' respect, everybody's respect in tennis. But there was a long period there where he had a pretty rocky relationship with the Australian press and the Australian public. I think for one thing, they were just annoyed that he wasn't Pat Rafter to start with, because Pat Rafter was this sort of
tough audience, isn't
it,
in that regard. I mean,
you know, Pat Rafter won Australian of the Year after he stopped playing tennis. He was just kicking his heels on a beach on Sunshine Beach, and he's still winning Australian of the Year. Poor old Leighton Hewitt had to enter into that arena.
And actually, it was the same with everybody, almost before and after Pat Rafter, because I think even Pat Cash probably suffered by comparison to Rafter when Rafter came along. I think that Mark Philippoussis, as effectively a contemporary of Pat Rafter, everybody in Australia in tennis was viewed as not Pat Rafter.
And Pat, you've made everyone's life an absolute nightmare. You're the Ryan Gosling of the tennis world.
Do you know Ryan Gosling? Or
no, I don't. But, you know, nobody... I've spoken to... goodness me, we're off topic already. This is what happens in our pub episodes. But I've spoken to men about the existence of Ryan Gosling, and it annoys them because nobody should be that charismatic. It just makes everybody else look bad. Oh. No man should be allowed to be that charismatic, because it's not fair on everyone else.
I won't go and look up who he is then.
I don't even think David Law is joking there. Just quickly, before we move on to the actual meat and bones of the developments in the tennis world this week, I went to the British Podcast Awards on Saturday, David.
Oh, yeah, did we win?
And I'm very surprised. I had a scan through the national papers on Sunday, and there was no reporting of the extraordinary Oscars-esque admin error that occurred at the awards on
what
Saturday
happened?
Night. I mean, I don't know where... Faye Dunaway, and who was the other one? Who was the other
Warren
one?
Warren Beatty, wasn't it?
Warren Beatty, yeah. I mean, it was of those proportions what occurred on Saturday night, and I'm surprised it hasn't received more press attention, frankly, because when the sports nominees were flashed up on that screen, there was horror in the room, as the tennis podcast wasn't there.
Shocked silence, indeed.
Shocked silence, yeah. Things were being thrown at the stage, recounts were being demanded.
That was just Catherine.
The free cheap wine was being thrown on the floor in disgust.
You didn't tell me there was free cheap wine. I would have come.
It was quite the... It was really cheap wine, David.
Really, I'd have definitely come then.
Really cheap wine. Anyway, it's freeze-free. There was some sort of horrendous miscarriage of justice on Saturday. If anyone involved with the British Podcast Awards is listening, we will forgive you, but only if you rectify the situation and restore justice at the 2018 Awards. We will be waiting intently for the nominees
list. Congratulations to whoever did win. Who was it?
It was a boxing podcast.
Oh, so it wasn't even the cycling
And they weren't
podcast.
There because there was a big boxing match happening on Saturday. So they didn't even bother to show up.
Didn't think that through,
Adam
did
Buxton
they?
Only showed up via video link.
So the cycling podcast was on the nominee list.
They were
so
on the nominee
right,
list,
then, isn't it? And
yeah.
Graham Hunter
there was
a
wrestling
well.
Podcast. I mean, I can't believe. Anyway, we digress. But I just can't believe
we got beaten by a wrestling.
We got
podcast.
Beaten by a wrestling podcast, and I don't want to talk about it anymore because they don't need the promotion, frankly. But anyway, 2018 is a new year for the British Podcast Awards. And for the tennis podcast, expectant success there. Should we talk about Stuttgart and the circus that rolled into town in Stuttgart?
I think we should.
Last week. I mean, it was all very much highlighted by Maria Sharapova in her first round press conference after beating Roberta Vinci. She was asked a question by Dan King of The Sun. And she immediately hit back by querying whether a Sun journalist had ever attended the Stuttgart event before, and made a quite pithy remark about, in fact, she referred to him as a virgin, didn't she? The Sun, a Stuttgart virgin, sort of highlighting and very much drawing attention to the fact that we all knew why everybody was there. I mean, of course, she was expecting it. I'm sure a portion of her relished it. The facts are, she reached the semi-finals. It was a very, very good week. It wasn't good enough to get her into the French Open main draw, French Open qualifying. She's up to 262 in the world. She lost out to Kiki Mladenovic, the finalist in the end. Where do we start, David? Let's start with her form, shall we? Let's start with her tennis. What do you make of
her
level?
I saw the first match. She was pretty erratic early on, particularly. She was unsurprisingly erratic. I mean, let's be honest, this is a player who hasn't played tournament tennis for 18 months. and she was hitting the back fence at times. She was hitting some screaming winners, but she just looked a bit out of sync, really, as you would expect her to be. But she still won the match against Roberta Vinci, who is a player who presents you with difficult balls to strike on a clay court in your first match back. I think that was a good win for her, frankly, for Maria Sharapova to come back with. She then beat Ekaterina Makarova and got herself to the semi-finals, beating Kontaveit on the way as well. I do find that interesting that she ended up losing to Mladenovic. I think that's a really good result from her perspective, but that's just on the court. So I think probably Sharapova looked better than I would have expected. I think it was a good set of results. I think it keeps it intriguingly open in terms of the wildcard situation, in as much as now we know the French Open has to make a decision.
Were they hoping they wouldn't have to make a decision? Well,
they'd already announced had the French Open that they were going to Facebook Live the announcement of whether she's getting a wildcard or not, which I have to say was, I thought, crikey, that feels a little opportunistic, to be honest. They're going to try and make a media event out of it.
But as if they were concerned that they wouldn't get quite enough publicity as it was about their announcement of the wild cards. I mean, that was the baffling aspect of that announcement for me, that there was never going to be any shortage of publicity for that announcement, whether it was Facebook Live or not. But hey, I suppose in for a penny, for a pound.
So that is open. We obviously still don't know the situation as regards to Wimbledon. She may end up still getting enough points to qualify, both for qualifying and for main draw for Wimbledon, because she's still got tournaments in Madrid and Rome that she can count towards that entry cutoff. But it was interesting to see that there were 200 journalists accredited for her first match. And that's an extraordinary number.
And we understand from Simon Briggs that plenty were turned away as well. Plenty applied and were turned away.
Yeah, it just goes to show the level of interest and some of the questions asked. I mean, maybe I'm biased, but particularly from the British journalists were pointed and put her on the spot, some of which I thought she handled really well. Others, I think she was quite prickly towards and quite dismissive. And there was a very interesting article by Oliver Holt over the weekend in the Mail on Sunday saying that she was condescending. And everybody's going to have a different view of that. I think she's been playing the PR game wrong all around.
That's a flattering edit of that Oliver Holt article, David. That's a very flattering edit of that article. Yeah, I mean, condescending is the tip of the iceberg of what he accuses her of. It's sort of righteousness and sneering, I think, is a word that he uses, and a superiority.
But it's very interesting that, depending on where you come from, different views of that press conference. Chris Clary said it was a fine press conference. Stuart Fraser called it a frosty press conference. A lot of people, depending on where you come from, had a different view of it, as many do of the saga itself.
And the other thing about, I can't imagine anybody disagreeing with words like superiority and righteousness. And as Oliver Holt points out in that Daily Mail article, what's particularly interesting about it is it's not unusual, that attitude, for people coming back from a doping ban. That does seem to be sort of the default attitude. There isn't much contrition. It's sort of, let's forget that now, and I'm above it all. And in fact, in response to one question, when she was quizzed about comments that Jeannie Bouchard has made, pretty outspoken comments that Jeannie Bouchard made this week about her being, quote, a cheater, she said, I'm above that. I'm not going to, because she actually said, I'm above that. And that pretty much sums up her whole position. And whatever you make of that, that is totally in keeping with Maria Sharapova's character, wasn't it? She had a total air of superiority and righteousness for which she made no apology and makes no apology before the doping ban, didn't she?
That's just her vibe. I think you're right. I think personality-wise, that is her default public position on things. I don't know what she's like away from the microphones and away from the cameras. I don't know her. I've interviewed her a couple of times. That is it. I know that a couple of journalists who've spoken to her at length of whose opinions I would trust, like Chris Clary, have said that he feels, and this was pre drugs test fail, that he thought there was a lot of depth to her. Now, I just can't comment other than to say that's what he said, because I haven't met her. But she has always come across to me as somebody a little sneering and certainly condescending, and that has certainly not changed, both in the way she's just gone about generally responding to this ban and the subsequent articles and comments that have been written and made about her over the course of it, and also in the response to coming back. It was the same Maria Sharapova. She was so self-assured, it seemed, in that press conference. It's quite uncomfortable for me sometimes to watch somebody who's that confident in her own skin, because
it's so difficult to relate to, isn't it?
We don't do that, really. No. We're not that good at being hugely self-confident. But I don't know. I saw John Wertheim, who's made the point a couple of times in Sports Illustrated's column, that he feels that she should have adopted a much different approach in coming back from this, and to be more contrite and to be less point scoring, which has felt like what she's been doing a lot of the time, and quoting this article from Oliver Holt in the Mail on Sunday. So, you know, and that certainly would have been the way I would have preferred to have seen her come back. It's the way I'd prefer anybody coming back from a doping test to come back, because let's be clear, there has been a failed test. That much is absolutely beyond question. So, you know, I think the world is owed just a little bit of contrition for that.
I think we might be waiting a long time, though. I mean, she's decided on this tack, and she is certainly sticking to it. You know, we discussed last week her manager Max Eisenbud's pretty outrageous comments about her fellow players that had spoken out.
She wasn't having any of it, was she?
Well,
she said,
pretty much, without saying I back him, she backed him. She had the opportunity to distance herself from those comments, and she firmly did not distance herself.
Maybe it's
from
just
them.
Loyalty, but I mean, I got the sense. Yeah, I mean, I got the sense she's probably thinking, well, yeah.
I do think there's an element of bubble. I do think these people are able to exist in a bubble. I think if you're that successful and that famous and that rich, and you can choose not to, you can choose to expose yourself to the realities of the sort of life that you and I and normal people live. But if you want to live in a bubble, you can. And
especially if you've got 15 million Facebook followers and you've got 100 million prize money in the bank,
Pova
whatever
fam,
it is.
Shara fam. Yeah, I still haven't looked up what they're called. But anyway,
We're watching the ultimate person living in a bubble in the United States at the moment, and he's running the country.
Two beers laws gets political.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, we've got somebody who's got a massive Twitter following there. He doesn't care what anybody else says. He says what he wants on Twitter, and he gets the responses he wants.
Must be just glorious to not give any hoots at all what anybody thinks. I mean, I'm glad I don't suffer that sort of lack of self-awareness, but I can see that there must be something so liberating about it. It must be great to be David Brent. Anyway, so she made it to the semi-finals, just quickly returning to her form, because the fact is we haven't seen her. We've seen her perform well, and I think generally speaking, exceed expectations. Hints of rustiness, as you said, but generally pretty good, particularly on serve and playing the big points.
She's lost none of what she had.
She's the ultimate competitor, yeah. Still, but we haven't seen her tested against a top player.
You know, it was interesting that after what a match, she was already being installed as the favourite for the French Open.
Now, that is extraordinary.
That seems
isn't it?
Absurd, but when you actually looked down the list of other players there, I mean, it was difficult to make a really strong case for somebody else.
Well, she was installed as a favourite, Muguruza was the favourite, which I get that she's defending champion, but I find that hard. I find it very hard for any educated tennis person to be thinking of her as the favourite to win the French Open.
The bookie who made those odds may have been after the sort of publicity that we're now giving them, because it is a great line to say Maria Sharapova is back after a 15-month ban and she's a favourite for the French Open. But when you actually look at the players in the list, with Serena Williams out of the sport, there's loads and loads of good players there. I would think, on form generally, I would say Simona Halep looks the best player to me, but she can throw in an awful performance just about any time, or somebody else can throw in a great one. She's not the sort of player who's going to blast away through the draw and you feel totally confident is going to win a Grand Slam. She's never won a Grand Slam before. Maria Sharapova has.
What about Kiki Mladenovic, top eight now?
Well, she showed in that match, and she's shown a couple of times this year, just what a threat she can be at any tournament, at any level. She has to piece it all together. That's the key.
And in France as well, which the French don't tend to do.
I have to say, though, I mean, I think she's perhaps the sort of character who may thrive with that spotlight. She seems to be quite a show person in that way. You know, somebody who just puffs her chest out, stands even taller with the glare of the spotlight on her. I don't know on a personal level to be able to judge that for sure, and I haven't seen enough big match experience of hers in France, but she's played Fed Cup. I think she could be a huge star in the next couple of years if she can put it all together in France.
It's extraordinary how much she's improved. I was really struck by that this week. I mean, I watched a full week of her in Acapulco earlier this year, and I wasn't underwhelmed by her. She had a really good week. She reached the final there, but technique-wise, I was having what so much of her, I was struck by the limitations of her technique. I thought, look, she's a great tennis player. I've talked before about how, in terms of sort of stature and poise and physique, she is the cookie cutter mold of a tennis player. You couldn't wish for anybody physically more perfect for a tennis player, but I thought there were some serious limitations to her technique, particularly on serve. She doesn't use her height brilliantly, but she, just from Acapulco to this week in Stuttgart, I was struck by the improvement in her game. I think she is learning how to use the doubles experience to her advantage, really learning how to use her experience at the net. She's not necessarily up at the net all the time and volleying all the time,
one.
But she's comfortable wherever she is on the court.
The thing with the doubles thing is that so often I feel as though doubles ends up detracting from a top singles player's game, because they either play too much or they get confused within a tournament and they've got all these matches backed up. And I agree with you, she's somebody who I think she might be able to piece it together, and because she's a more natural player at the net, I think she's somebody who has that general framework to her game that could be part
she's
of
got good
her
balance
makeup,
hasn't she,
you know?
She's very, yeah. She seems to be very well balanced on the court. Laura Siegmund, David, she won the tournament.
She's a joy to
watch.
She's
amazing.
She's a joy.
I put to you, now you came up with the drop shot dragon tag.
For Albert
Portas. Yeah. Could we have a women's drop shot dragon?
Why not? Why not?
And could it be Laura Siegmund?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought up the drop shot dragon. Everybody, that is my favourite.
Any opportunity.
Ever made up.
You know it's on his Wikipedia page.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I'm so proud.
Because I, for some reason, he came up in conversation on tennis radio, and I was commentating that I cannot recall why Albert Portas came up, and I went, oh, drop shot dragon. And I checked his Wikipedia page as that came up to see how official the term was, and it's in his bio, it's in the intro.
I'm so
David,
pleased.
You
know,
you have literally made tennis history,
just a little bit of background. I gave him this nickname when I was working for the ATP back in 2000, and he played against our good friend Jeff Taranto in a match in Umag in Croatia, and he drop shotted him so many times, particularly on the forehand, that Jeff wanted to wrap his racket round his throat, right? And so in the media notes that I was writing that day, I just called him the drop shot dragon for some reason, and I don't even know why. That's what I did.
This and is what happens when you give David Law editorial control.
And then what I did is I thought, that sounds quite good actually. I'm just going to keep calling him
he
that.
He goes, oh, I quite like my own idea.
Yeah, I do. So, so
you should see the pride on David Law's
face.
I'm going to take a photo
just
while
a minute.
He tells this story.
So I called him this for the next 6 months. And, you know, to anybody who would listen, frankly.
He's not joking.
We got to the Hamburg tournament, the Hamburg ATP tournament, which was there, was the old Madrid Masters 1000 tournament, and Albert Portas succeeded to beat both Leighton Hewitt, who was then world number one, and Juan Carlos Ferrero, who would be a French Open champion. He beat them both to win the tournament. He won Hamburg, right? And at his final press conference, I led him into the press conference room, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, your Hamburg champion, the drop-shot dragon, Albert Portas.
Did the room erupt?
First question, why do they call you the drop-shot dragon?
And he goes, so on my Wikipedia
he page. Goes, he goes, he just sort of shuffled on his seat and he looked at me to his left and he goes, well, he gave it to me. And I said, yeah, but that's because it fits, doesn't it, everybody? And they all said, well, yeah, absolutely. When did you start hitting drop shots like that? Because he was relentlessly drop shotting both Juan Carlos Ferrer and Leighton Hewitt to distraction. So there we are.
On the next podcast, we're going to get Goran Ivanišević to tell us why he calls David Law the Eagle.
No, you're not.
And the smile has gone. So we digress. Laura Siegman, the new drop shot dragon, David.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've convinced me. That's fine. Well, we've got to think of something else because there is only one drop shot dragon, and that's Albert Portas. So
I test your nickname skills.
Leave it with me. Just leave it with me is all I can say. But anyway, I couldn't agree more with you. She's a joy to watch. I first saw her, I think probably really took notice of her last year, I think at the same tournament.
Yeah, she reached the final.
Yeah, she was fantastic. I think she... Who did she beat along the way?
She was a qualifier. She beat Halep. She beat Radvanska. Yeah.
That was it. I commentated on those matches. And I remember sitting with Sam Smith and Anne Kyothavong. And I knew very little about her. And they just said, just watch the way she plays a point and then turns away. And it's business as usual and onto the next one. And it was really noticeable how positive and optimistic and upbeat she was. And just made you think, oh, this is somebody who's getting the most out of what she's got.
And she's 29. She made her first Grand Slam main draw in 2015, won her first title last year. This is by far her biggest title. I mean, her story is a joy. She's a joy to watch. She's just tremendous.
Yeah, no, she is. And very much congratulations to her.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a quick, I mean, I mentioned Radvanska there. What a horrid year she's having. She lost first round. Of course, this time last week, we were anticipating the possible second round match between her and Maria Sharapova, which didn't happen because Radvanska didn't win through. Speaking of torrid years, torrid perhaps an overstatement, but I suppose relative to expectations, Angelique Kerber, another early loss. It's another early loss that she's talking about in isolation. She's saying, oh, it's just a bad week for me, you know, move on, hope for a better week next week. Yeah. But she surely has to be looking at the bigger picture, doesn't she?
Well,
it's more than just
but how,
a bad week followed
what else,
by
what do you do,
bad
then?
Weeks in isolation. I don't know.
What I mean is, if she were to look at it in any other way, how could she come through it?
You go away and you think, there's something big going wrong here that I need to analyse, rather than just, sounds to me like she's just closing her eyes and hoping that it'll be different next week.
I mean, let's not forget, 6 months ago she was beating everybody, so if she were to make a fundamental change to her game or to her technique or to her preparation or to her coaching team, that would be a huge step to take. This is somebody who was fantastic last year. I don't think it's like a football team sacking the manager after a half a dozen bad results, isn't it? Do you not go away and look at them in isolation?
I don't think she needs to throw any babies out with any bathwater.
She looks at it on a grand level,
there needs to be
level,
a bit more. Maybe she.
Isn't it a defence mechanism to stop herself panicking?
Precisely. Maybe it is. But maybe she needs to panic a bit. I don't know. Maybe that's what she's saying.
Panic
in press
is
and
never
private.
Good, is it? Whenever I panic on the tennis court,
fear,
it all goes wrong.
Sometimes the fear can lead to good things. You know,
is that what happened to you against your brother after 6 years of failure?
I don't even fear losing to him anymore.
Oh, okay.
No. You can't.
Coach Catherine, what is your solution for Angelique Kerber then?
A sports psychologist, maybe. She's probably already seeing one. What top player would, you know, it's all about leaving no stone unturned, isn't it? I mean, maybe she's already seeing one, but...
Honestly, you know, I don't think it is anything much more complicated than the fact that she is a very good player, but not a great player, and she's somebody who's absolutely wrung the last drop out of herself last year to overachieve, and... Okay, I think she's better than what she's producing right now, but she's more or less returning to the mean at the moment, and lower than that. But I think there's a limit to what she can do, and I think the problem is when you win as big as she did, you get compared to that level, and she's not that level really.
I think that's great analysis.
She's a top 10 player.
And I agree with you. And it was something that Simon Briggs talked about in our preview podcast at Australian Open. Really, he described it really well, her sort of technique, her frankly quite awkward technique, and how extraordinary it is that she's got to world number one, and she's absolutely deserved to. But, you know, it's a game which you would expect there to be limitations to. What worries me is how little enjoyment she seems to be getting from playing tennis. That's what I read more
and
into.
I think the other problem with winning as big as she did and then not winning is, yeah, the contrast is so extreme. She's been used to 5 years of winning quite a lot and being top 10 in the world and being a really, really good player. Suddenly last year she was winning virtually every week, and she was world number one, and she won two slams. She got to the final of another one. She got to Olympic final. I mean, she played a Roger Federer year last year, really, or a Serena Williams year. I mean, that's not Angelique Kerber, typically. All credit to her for having done it, but I think it must be very difficult if you are in any way in your own mind comparing yourself to that, because the chances are she's not going to live up to that.
I'm loath to repeat it, but excellent analysis, David Law. Oh. Do you know what I'm going to let you do as a reward to your excellent analysis?
What's that?
Do you want to go and get another beer?
Go on then.
Two Beers Law on the way.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right then, David's well is replenished. And I think we've pretty wholeheartedly covered what happened in Stuttgart last week on the WTA Tour. So let's talk about Barcelona and the ATP Tour, and the fact that Rafael Nadal has won his second La Decima. Oh. Just giving me the opportunity to say La Decima, and I do it with a gesture, with a sort of Spanish gesture with my hand.
I really feel like I need to take a picture of you doing that with the hand.
I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like a Spanish chef describing his creation. Yes, he's done his second La Decima of the year.
He has, hasn't he? And he's done it. I mean, I didn't watch all of the matches. I watched some of the matches. But he's winning these titles now in regulation fashion, as though he does it all the time, as though he used to do it, as though, frankly, it doesn't matter what anybody else does. He's going to win these these big matches. He's going. I mean, he's not. He was barely pushed, wasn't he, last week in Barcelona, and he beat Dominic Thiem in the final 6-4, 6-1, who is probably the other most explosive clay courter in the world right now, and he beat him handily, comfortably. Yeah, watch out, everybody, is all I can say, because I don't see Nadal being stopped. It can happen. He was playing pretty well last year on clay, and then he had the wrist problem. Right now, if he's fully fit, I don't see anybody stopping him.
I don't either. It's so different to what we were discussing with, you know, producing a list of bookies' favourites on the women's side. I mean, on the way you're sort of looking, you're looking for standout favourites, and you really, well, I can't see any anywhere. On the men's side, there is one head and shoulders favourite, and then there's everybody else. I don't think he's a head and shoulders favourite in the way that he was in the late noughties.
No, of course not. I mean, and there is still a fragility, I think, that wasn't there back then. I think that certain players can get to him with big power, and look, Kyle Edmund pushed him in Monte Carlo, but there's nobody else of the top players that are in that great form at the moment. I mean, I tell you what.
No, timing is everything. I talk about it so much on this podcast. The timing is everything.
What if he plays Federer?
We don't give enough credit to it.
What if he plays Federer at the French Open? You know, Federer having put his feet up for 6 months.
You say what if?
The
chances are.
6 weeks.
The way this tennis season is going.
I mean,
that might happen.
Federer would come out having won, their last three, and feeling like he's cracked the code.
And somehow, despite having won their last three, despite being the standout player of 2017, he would once again be the underdog, which is exactly what he's enjoyed being.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, no, everything. Life is just, it just can't get more perfect for Roger Federer.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting if that happened. And I don't know, I think Federer is likely to sail through the opening few rounds. I mean, I suppose timing could be an issue, getting onto clay, having not played it for such a long time.
He'd get Del Potro first round.
I don't even think that would be a horror, because the ball comes into his strike zone.
You get Ramos Vinolas round three.
Yeah, someone like that might be a problem. Somebody who's got big spin and takes him out of the court early on. But, you know, imagine playing Roger Federer, who's got nothing to lose. I mean, that's how he views
everyone's
it.
Everyone's worst nightmare.
You know,
that's Roger Federer for the rest of his career now, isn't it? That's Roger Federer in every match he plays now.
I don't agree with that, because I think when he comes to Wimbledon, he'll feel differently. I think he'll feel pressure to achieve and to succeed and to back up what he's done early on in this year. Still, I don't think it'll stop him, because he can handle it. He can handle it, but when you see Roger Federer in practice, I'm loath to ever talk about players in practice, because I don't know what I'm talking about, and all players look brilliant in practice to me.
But plenty of people that don't know what they're talking about do tweet, "Oh, it looks great in practice."
Well, they do say that. But Roger Federer trick shots, and he fools around, and he plays shots that I can't even imagine other players trying. And now he's trying them in matches. This is the interesting thing.
That was how the Sabre came about, wasn't it?
He
was just having a bit of fun.
But very quickly, it is, as a neutral, I think if you can't rejoice in seeing Nadal do what he used to do, just the same way as Federer doing what he used to do, then there's something wrong with you, because this is great.
No, I do absolutely rejoice in it. I'm loving it. I just wish you'd do it a bit more quickly. Watching Federer come back, and particularly watching his matches against Kyrgios, his match against Kyrgios, and just watching a lot of Kyrgios and a lot of Federer, as I have done recently, I've realised how much I enjoy the game being played at a fast pace. And going back to watching a lot of Nadal. Between points, yeah. It didn't used to bother me that much. When it's been this hot topic, as it has been for the past 5 or so years, I've accepted that it is an issue, because other tennis fans see it as an issue, and therefore it is. It's never particularly bothered me, but it has been of late, because I think tennis generally slowed down and everybody was playing quite slowly, and now there's a bit of a move in the other direction, and you've got Federer and Kyrgios, and Stan Wawrinka plays pretty quickly. I mean, Murray and Djokovic don't, But it suddenly is striking me a bit more, and it suddenly is frustrating me a bit. But anyway, I mean, it's not fair to him really to bring up that
negative. Can I talk about Andy Murray quickly?
Well, hang on, David. I've got an agenda here. He's on it. He's just not on it yet.
Okay, fine.
I was just going to mention, because I mentioned Albert Ramos-Vinolas there, we've already obviously mentioned Dominic Thiem, who reached the final in Barcelona, and it was pretty great last week. Beat Andy Murray, who you'll get to talk about in a minute, David.
Got a specific theme, by the way.
But we looked at the rankings before we came on air for this podcast, and handily in the rankings, it tells you the player, their age, the number of points they have, and it tells you how many tournaments they played to reach that ranking. Albert Ramos-Vinolas has played 31 tournaments in the past 12 months. And that is more than anybody else
than
in his
Thiem.
Vicinity. I mean, I can't see anybody that's... I mean, yeah, it's more than Dominic Thiem,
who's played...
The reason we looked at it was for the reference point of Dominic Thiem, who is the next most at 29. And let me tell you, that is so many more than anybody else ranked anywhere near him. So he's 9 in the world. He's at 29 tournaments in the past 12 months. And the next closest to that is Marin Cilic at 22.
And then if you look at other players up above, Stan Wawrinka's played 20, Rafa Nadal's played 15, Djokovic 16, Murray 18.
And Andy Murray 18, and that's with Andy Murray playing, you know, he played pretty much week in, week out at the back end of last year in that assault for the world number one ranking. So that was with a more full schedule than we're used to seeing Andy Murray play with. And yet we've got, yeah, I don't want to labour the Dominic Thiem point, but there he is at 29. And there, Albert Ramos-Vinolas is at 31 tournaments. Somebody let him have a nap.
Yeah, passed.
Have a week off,
He can have a nap.
It's paying off for him. I mean, he very nearly beat Andy Murray for a second time. Cue opportunity for David Lord to talk about Andy Murray.
Just two things I wanted to say. One is that, first of all, I think that is a big week for Andy Murray. I think that win over Albert Ramos-Vinolas is a big week, big win for Andy Murray, because he lost to him in Monte Carlo. And midway through that match, I'm thinking, if he wins this, it's quite a statement to himself that he's just starting to dig into these matches and just find that inner beast again, you know, that guy of, come on man, I'll take you all on, and your mates, and, you know, I will not be denied. That look in his eye, that look of yeah, I'm ready to face anything, anyone, anywhere.
I agree with you, David, and I felt exactly the same when he found the way through to beat Albert Ramos-Vinolas. And then I was expecting him to push on and beat Dominic Thiem. I was expecting it to be a battle. I was expecting Thiem to challenge him. But I did feel like...
I wasn't. I think it's too early for that one. I think if those two play each other at the French Open, then I think
you'd always favour Murray over best of five.
Yes, and that's obviously what they've got to peak towards. But I just feel that these top players, and Andy Murray and Djokovic, I mean, it'll be interesting to see which Djokovic we get when we get to the French Open, whether he's fit enough or not. But they have a sixth sense about how to peak in a way that the other guys don't. And part of that is that scheduling. You've just seen it. Dominic Thiem is playing 11 more tournaments a year than Andy Murray, many more than the other guys. So, I think really good signs from Andy Murray. The other thing I just wanted to say is, I was thinking the other night about clay court tennis and why I love the clay court season so much. The thing I love about it is when hard court and grass court specialists come onto clay and they're the best players in the world year round, top five in the world, and then they have to bring that to clay. And I was thinking about this over the last 20 years. If I go back 20 years to Andre Agassi when he was world number one, wonderful backcourt player, took the ball early, and then he brought that onto clay and took on Carlos Moyer and Albert Costa and Alex Correia, Alberto Berrettini, players like this. I used to love all of that. And I think the same still applies today, less so because you don't see as many players going for it, I don't think, on the hard court players. We talked about the Americans, not enough of them are playing it. But I love seeing them collide, those two worlds, you know?
quick one on Dominic Thiem. We've made the point pretty firmly about his schedule, etc., etc. Obviously, a great week for him. He played some extraordinary tennis. I loved every minute of watching Dominic Thiem last week until the final, and I felt like that was a Dominic Thiem match that I'd seen before. I felt like as soon as he lost that first set, when he was very competitive, I knew what was going to happen in the second set, and my mind was cast back to what you said about David Goffin last week when I put it to you. You know, did he fall away a bit too quickly after the disappointment of what happened with the umpire's intervention and the disappointment of that, as understandable as it was? And you said, yes, it was a bit disappointing, but let's see how he would deal with that situation again next time. Will he learn from it? Will he deal with it better the second time? And I just felt like, look, I am a huge Dominic Thiem fan. I love watching him play tennis so much, particularly on the clay. His explosive power and shot making of both wings is unreal. And I love his temperament. I like his attitude. He's fantastic. But I knew he was going to lose that second set really easily. And I that feeling didn't sit right for me, because he's probably the third or fourth best clay court player in the world, really, at the moment. And you don't want to be feeling that sinking feeling of, oh, this match is over after one set with one of the best clay court players in the world.
Yeah, you don't. And we had a similar situation, I think, in the semi-finals of the French Open last year against Djokovic. He just couldn't really get competitive. But I think time will tell with him. I mean, he's still young. He's putting out consistent results, but he's at the moment he's just knocking on the door of those biggest ones. Be interesting to see whether he can break through it or not. And I'm not convinced mindset-wise. Game-wise, I am. I think he's a fabulous player. He is Stan Wawrinka in so many ways. They are so similar, their games. And if Stan can do it game-wise, then Dominic Thiem can do it. But
he's not an ox in the way that Stan Wawrinka is, though, is he? He's got a fantastic physique. He's got sort of this Federer-esque balance physique. He's sort of a bit more slight, but his timing is so perfect that he can get the power without the muscle somehow. But yeah, in terms of shot making off both wings, it's hard to compare him to anybody but Stan Wawrinka, really. There's a couple of any other business items on the agenda, but just very, very quickly, it's not a big talking point, but before we move on to those, I just want to mention Sasha Zverev, who we've spoken of so much on the podcast, and I've said I think he's a future world number one. I stand by that, but it's interesting, isn't it? These young players that are talked about so much, and nobody believes in Sasha Zverev more than Sasha Zverev. We know that. He's got the swagger, but he's hitting the first little bit of adversity, isn't he? He was hit with a pretty chastening experience against Rafael Nadal in Monte Carlo last week, a match that a lot of people thought he would challenge in. And then this week in Barcelona, he was hit with a pretty hefty defeat at the hands of another next-gen player, Hyun Chung, 6-4, 6-1, I think it was. That, I think, will have really stung. Do you think it might be good for him to have a slightly chastening period and realise it's not going to all come really easily?
I think the reference point is Federer. And when I think of Federer's curve, he came along as a 17-year-old. He played his debut at 16. He played his first real pro year at 17, 18. He got his big win over Sampras at 19. Took him another 2 years to win a slam after that.
Federer biographer.
And Federer had some pretty rough, ropey times during that 3 or 4 years. He had some big wins.
Yeah, he lost to Mario Andrić first, Louis Horner at the French Open.
And if you look at some of his other tournaments, the Barcelonas and all these sort of tournaments, he had long periods of not doing very well and underachieving. And there was.
Do you think it helped him in the long run?
I just think it was all part of the building blocks. It depends what it does to you along the way. When it was Dimitrov that we were in the situation with, I think scar tissue emotionally and psychologically built up. And he's. I thought he'd banished that at the start of this year, but I mean, it feels like it's building again a little bit. He feels that much more up and down. I think also his interest level may wax and wane a little bit compared to a guy like Zverev, who I actually think seems to have a really good approach. He cares massively.
He's keyed in
all
the time.
And I think that he. He will work it out. I don't think he's as talented as Roger Federer. As good as he is, I don't think he is that talented.
I mean,
at
that
all.
Applies to the other 7 billion people in
well,
the world.
Well, of course it does. But,
that's
you know,
not a criticism.
I would not be worried about Alexander Zverev. I think the bigger concern would be when I watched him play Kyrgios, I actually thought Kyrgios just looked, frankly, a better player. And it will be interesting to see whether Zverev can develop his game to start winning those matches when they come. I think he's also playing a bit too much, too many tournaments, Zverev, at the moment.
Still not as many as Dominic Thiem, though. In Budapest this week, lovely city, by the way. That is one of my favourite European cities, provided we're talking about Budapest, Hungary, and not Budapest, you know, Mexico, or Budapest, California.
Well, knowing you, we are.
I haven't fact-checked that we are talking about Budapest, Hungary, but I do feel confident on this one. Aliaš Bedene, okay, he lost in the final to Luka Puig, but he came off the back of two back-to-back challenger victories. He was outside the top 100. In Australia this year, he looked completely bereft, and, you know, we've talked about how sometimes his press conferences can feel like therapy sessions. What I mean, I'm just so full of admiration for him and what he's doing out of the spotlight, aside from anything that's going on with the Davis Cup and the tussles with all the federations he's got going on. He's just quietly playing great tennis.
Yeah, he is. I don't think I expected this at all. I thought he was a good player who would, you know, have some good weeks and probably be getting to the top 50, but I did not see him. I know it's slightly lower level, but I did not see him put in 15 match win run in together. I did not see that at all from him. So fair play to the guy. Great achievement. Also a note on the guy who beat him in the final, Luka Puig, who is from that generation, and he doesn't get anything like the degree of coverage, I don't feel, as Kyrgios and Zverev and others.
He sort of did very briefly when he beat Nadal.
Yeah, but it
at the US Open, but then it faded very quickly.
It was Nadal-related. It was the fact that he beat Nadal. It wasn't about him. And then when he played the Davis Cup, and I thought, you know, we'll get a sense of what this guy's like. Will he? We're talking about Mladenovic. What are they like in front of a French crowd? He grew. He grew. He puffed his chest out and looked a bigger, stronger, better player. And he's backed that up. Since then, he's been really, really impressive ever since. And he's got a bit more to him than I thought, because he's winning these tournaments and he's beating people he should beat. And I always feel that that's a good sign.
Beating people you should beat.
Yeah. Because, it's easy to get excited against big names. But can you just keep clocking in and clocking out and beating the guys that on paper you should be able to beat? Well, he's doing that.
Damn right, David, damn right. You're speaking an awful lot of sense this week. I don't know
what's
happened
to
Two Beers Law, but anyway, a bit of any other business this week is baby related, because in terms of baby related news, obviously the Serena news is very much old by now, although what is new about the Serena old baby news is that she's revealed that she revealed it by accident.
Yes.
The Instagram post that she put out.
Snapchat,
she
Catherine. Snapchat.
Was it?
Get with it.
I don't understand.
Even I know about
Snapchat.
That.
It makes me feel ancient.
I don't know what it is.
I saw my 11-year-old cousins last week and they were trying to Snapchat me, and it all went. It just didn't happen because I'm not on Snapchat. Anyway. So she revealed that her Snapchat post revealing that she was pregnant had actually been intended to just be a private record. She was taking weekly photos of herself as a sort of private photo diary of her pregnancy, and she accidentally, almost by reflex, put on. I mean, that happens to me all the time. I don't know about you, David.
Yeah, on my Snapchat.
But it brings us on to the baby-related subject. And Novak Djokovic was revealed today. I mean, it's hardly news. It was very much an open secret, I suppose, in the tennis world, that he is expecting his second baby with wife Yelena. I think that's due this summer after Wimbledon, I think. I hope they've timed it for after Wimbledon. But anyway, he's expecting his second baby, which brings us on to baby chat. And handily, Simon Briggs has been thinking about this week. I mean, obviously, we've got Azarenka coming back later this year. And there was a fantastic interview that Chris Clary did with her in the New York Times this week. He travelled to Belarus to meet her there, to go to her old tennis club where she played when she was younger, to go to where she trains now. And just, I mean, it's fascinating. It really, really is an interesting character study of her, somebody who we have both talked about, David, as being sort of really misunderstood, I think, by fans and the media. I think there's an awful lot to her. I find her a very engaging, interesting individual who's been widely misunderstood. And I think maybe this whole journey that she's on and coming back from having a baby might make her better understood by the media. I don't know. It would be interesting to see. But anyway, it's prompted Simon Briggs to write a very interesting article in The Telegraph about how female players coming back after pregnancy, after having a baby, could start to become the norm on the tour, especially as the life expectancy of tennis careers grows longer, it seems, both in the men's and women's game. It seems to be that it's no longer the norm that you expect women to pack up and retire once they get pregnant. You don't instantly think that. And Serena has been very open with her intentions at this stage to come back after she's had her first baby. And Simon Briggs has caught up with Kim Clijsters, who knows a thing or two about coming back from pregnancy. She wrote the book on it, and this is what she had to say to Simon Briggs about it.
You do have to do a lot of exercises. I mean, you know, you start from zero, and you know you have a few weeks. Like, if you have an injury, you're still able to work out, but you find ways to do it. But in the pregnancy, you can train your stomach muscles and you can train. So you start from zero, and it's every day. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of boring exercises, but it comes back fast. And I think that's something that I noticed with mine. Even now after three, like, I feel like, okay, after a third, it's a little bit harder, but your body is so used to being a certain way because of your sport that it's easier.
Did you have to stop being quite as gymnastic afterwards? I mean, you're known for your incredible flexibility.
That was not a problem? No, I didn't feel any limitations.
Oh, good.
But I do link that to starting off slowly and making sure that I trained, you know, the post-pregnancy exercise and the muscles very well, and I didn't rush into it because I didn't think I was going to play again. That's one big difference, I think.
Oh, really?
I didn't plan to play again until a year after I had the baby. Like, I had time, I enjoyed being a mother and only worried about that for, you know, a few months, and with Jada I was breastfeeding for almost a year, and so I wanted to take my time to do that. I didn't want to rush into, because I didn't think about playing tennis again, and then that feeling kind of grew again. I think it's a different approach. If you see Azarenka and if you see Serena, they're already talking about coming back, whereas for me that definitely wasn't the case.
And that made it easier, probably, in some ways.
I feel like I had time to be a mother and to do that 100% and to you know, enjoy every aspect and just being home with the baby and taking everything in and because it's an emotional ride but it's still no tennis trophy will compare to giving birth and I'm really excited, you know, for Serena to experience it after everything that she's already done in tennis and in her life. I'm really excited for her to experience motherhood.
So that's Simon Briggs very opportunistically catching up with Kim Clijsters. Was what better person to talk about coming back from pregnancy? I mean, those scenes of her at the US Open winning there with her daughter Jada on the court with her and the trophy are so vivid, I think, in every tennis fan's mind. Of course, she did it again as well. I mean, it's extraordinary. And look, we said it last week when we were talking about Serena Williams' announcement. It's really difficult to make sweeping generalizations about pregnancy. I mean, look, I don't know a thing about pregnancy, but I do know that everybody experiences it differently. And I have heard some very well-meant, well-intentioned statements and comments out there sort of making assumptions about how Serena Williams will experience pregnancy on the basis of how they or their wives or people they know have, and sort of saying things like, you know, all your career and Grand Slam achievements will somehow pale into significance and seem less important in light of having this wonderful thing in your life. And maybe it will. But if it doesn't, that doesn't mean she's a bad mother. And if it does, it doesn't mean she's less of a champion. You know, who knows how it will affect her mentally. David is smiling at me in a go on, David, what have you got to say?
I don't know what I'm smiling at you as in, but I know that you're absolutely right. I mean, everybody's different, and I know enough people who've had kids, women who've had babies, men who've been fathers, to know that no two situations are the same necessarily. So all I can do is hope that Serena Williams enjoys her pregnancy and that it all goes well, and that she's very happy, and hopefully as well, just from a very selfish perspective as a tennis fan, hope she comes back as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it's really difficult, isn't it? We want to analyse it, and it's so interesting, especially that she stated her intention to come back this early. You know, Azarenka didn't do that, Clijsters didn't do that. In fact, in that interview with Simon, she said, I didn't know that I was going to come back, and that affected sort of her, it took her, the road back was a bit longer. We want to analyse it, we want to talk about it, but then at the same time we're saying we can't really analyse it because everyone's different and we don't have a clue. So on the we don't have a clue note, we've got quite a busy week for people that don't have a clue about the tennis world. We're both at Queen's tomorrow, David. Queen's suddenly, see, it's weird, isn't it? Because the clay court season is very much in full swing, and yet, due to the fact that there is absolutely no gap between the clay court season and the grass court season, we have to be sort of thinking about the grass court season whilst we're very much enjoying and in the depths of the clay court season. So we'll be at Queen's tomorrow, and you're just swinging casually into Madrid for the day on Thursday,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, as most of the tennis world appears to be. Because, first of all, just to say, Queen's, as you say, we're going to be there tomorrow. And during the Aegon Championships at Queen's, we will have a daily tennis podcast, won't we, Catherine Whittaker? Presented by Catherine and our good friend Gigi Salmon, friend of the pod, of course. So that's that to look forward to. Just to say, two little things. One is that it's been decided that Andy Murray is going to play on the Tuesday of Queen's, his first match, and there are a few tickets left, so if you want to go and get one of those, AegonChampionships.com,
that's good, isn't it?
To do so.
I think more tournaments should do that.
Well, it is.
I mean,
helps.
I know it's not always easy for tournaments to do, and I understand why they...
You can only do it with one or two, can't you?
Yeah, you can, really? But I think... I've been in a ticket buying fan situation trying to second guess what tournaments will do and when they'll schedule the big players, but I think that's a leg up to fans.
Yeah. So Andy Murray, if you want to see him, Tuesday, what is it, the 20th of June, he'll be playing, so go and get your tickets. And on Thursday of this week, Thursday the 4th of May, Tiebreak 10's edition number 3 will take place in Madrid, a men's and women's tournament running side by side.
That was a whoop.
Was it? Okay, good, yeah.
In celebration of it being men's and women's.
So we don't have to have our own
been in the pop
sound effect bank. We've just got Catherine Whittaker with her sound effects. And, basically an 8-player tournament for the men, 8-player tournament for the women. Both of them knockout. Both of them winner-takes-all, $200,000 on the line. If you're in the UK, you can watch it on Dave, which is a TV channel that I particularly like.
International listeners are probably very confused, but Dave is a TV show.
There you go.
It's not Dave Levy. You can't watch it on Dave Levy.
Well, I love that name. So there we are. And, players that have already signed up on the women's side, Garbiñe Muguruza, French Open champion, Joe Contis playing, Radvanska, Halep, Sharapova's playing. They're all playing, Catherine Whittaker. Madison Keys.
It's
not bad, is it?
It's a good field.
It's a decent field. And on the men's side, there is Stan Wawrinka.
Any wild cards? Because $200,000 sounds all right.
Well, you're not having one.
In a tie-break situation, I think, you know...
You fancy yourself.
I think the element of surprise could take me so far.
It'd be a big surprise you've been in it, wouldn't it?
Just saying, you know, if you've got any sway with the tournament organisers, just put my name in the mix.
You would not be mentioned. Also on the bloke side, so Stan Wawrinka, Luca Puy, who we were talking about earlier. There is also, I don't even know who's playing, to be honest with you. I can't quite remember
David
who's playing.
David Ferrer,
yeah, he was playing. He's not anymore. So You can tell we're in the pub, can't you? So anyway, yeah, it's a good old field, and there's loads of players in it, and it's going to be on Thursday at 6:30 UK time, 7:30 local time in Madrid, and you'll be able to watch exactly what happens. Catherine
Dave,
is frantically looking it up on the website, because my mind is
gone. Fernando Verdasco?
Oh, there we are. Yeah, Fernando Verdasco. Feliciano Lopez, I know, is playing as well. So yeah,
just frantically naming Spaniards now. Thomas Burdick, Grigor Dimitrov. You forgot Grigor.
I forgot Grigor. Hey, there's a player there that I didn't even know was in it.
Dan Evans.
Dangerous Dan.
He snuck his way into the podcast again.
Who'd have thought it?
At
Thomas
the very
Burdick
last.
And Jack Sock. So there we
did
are.
You save Wawrinka? You saved Wawrinka. That's a good
Wawrinka
field as well. Made all the better by Big Dan.
There you go.
We have been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with your...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Sport, and we will be back next week.